This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The city has made green-oriented projects a priority, and so, too, have some developers and architects. The issue of sustainable development here is viewed as important as a way to improve housing opportunities and to lower the carbon footprint. I spoke earlier with some local individuals involved in that effort. Here is our pre-recorded conversation. We're joined now by Paul Yankee, president of Green Building Consulting. Paul, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Oh, glad to be here.
Also with us is Elizabeth Rojas, Green Umbrella Cincinnati 2030 District Director. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Allison Beer McKenzie is Sustainability Director at architecture firm SHP and past president of Cincinnati Architecture Institute of America. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
We're glad to have all of you with us today. Paul, let's start with you. We're talking about sustainable development. And for my sake and the sake of many of our listeners, I imagine, would you mind just giving us a broad overview of what a sustainable development is, what one would look like?
Sure. I think the best definitions I've heard usually revolve around make sure it have less negative impacts in the development for a life cycle of the development. In most cases, what we're looking for is not for any kind of sustainable development. We're looking for the sustainability in the process of creating that development, but also in the maintenance of that development long-term. And then it has to be sustainable, meaning more positive impact than less for the residents, the businesses, jobs, all of the outcomes of that development as well.
So from your purview as a Cincinnati-based green consultant, where does the city stand as a metro area as it compares to other similar situated and populated areas of the country as it relates to sustainable development?
I think we surprisingly punch above our weight on occasion, and it always, I think it surprises individuals that go outside into more, would seem more progressive areas of the country. But I don't know that they keep up as well as we do for what we have as resources. We're blessed with a lot of passion, a lot of talent, and a few very opportunistic kind of headwind or tailwinds, I think at some point, that have allowed us to grow a market pretty amazingly. So areas in residential development for green buildings, for example, we are well ahead of the average top 100 city in the country. And in most cases, well ahead of most cities. In commercial development, I'd say we're also well ahead of the average. And then you get to Ohio with schools, things like that, and you're exceeding most states. So I believe, and Allison probably knows this best, I would say I think we're in the top 8 or 9 at all times for most amount of LEED buildings, for example, as one great metric, which is pretty impressive.
Allison McKenzie is the sustainability director at the architecture firm SHP. Allison, is what Paul said correct? You have extensive experience with LEED LEED projects.
I won't attest to the actual number that we currently are, but we definitely lead the nation in LEED projects. And that's the result of several factors. I think the city has been really, really forward thinking as far as linking tax abatements to LEED certification and other sustainability criteria. And also the state of Ohio through their Ohio Facilities Construction Commission that is responsible for many of the education projects in the region, has also required LEED certification for all of the new and major renovations that they do to school buildings that they help fund. So I think that while those incentives are really helpful, I think we also have a great network of progressive building owners, developers, people who are interested in sustainability as well. So I think all of those things together really lead to a really great number of sustainability-focused, LEED-specific projects.
Allison, you mentioned tax abatements in the city. what type of tax abatement tends to be available for such a project, and why are they important?
Sure. So the city has two tax abatement programs related to sustainability, one that's geared towards, you know, single family residential and one that's geared more towards commercial development. And both currently have kind of a LEED available function. Some tax abatements are available simply for renovation work and new construction within the city limits, but they have for the past quite a few years linked additional levels of abatement, either in number of years or amount that's available for abatement to the achievement of LEED certification. And I know that Paul definitely works very closely with some of the residential portions of that in particular, and I have certainly helped walk some clients through the commercial aspect of it as well. So whenever you can save your clients money down the road and not just at the construction standpoint, that is definitely a huge selling feature for them.
We should note that the LEED or LEED program is run by the U.S. Green Building Council, and they, I guess, involve these developments. They evaluate these developments, and if the developments qualify and meet certain standards, they receive a LEED certificate. Elizabeth Rojas is Green Umbrella, Cincinnati 2030 District Director. Elizabeth, we've done some programs on Cincinnati Edition related to the 2030 District. Remind our listeners what exactly that is.
Yeah. So we are part of Green Umbrella, which is our sustainability, local sustainability alliance. And interestingly, though, the Cincinnati 2030 District is part of a national organization as well, which is a network of other 2030 districts. And we have, there's 22 districts in North America, and we're relatively new to the stage. So we became an official district in very late 2018, and around the same time became a part, an initiative of Green Umbrella. So Green Umbrella saw the 2030 district as a great opportunity to grow into the commercial building sector and start to make headway in those areas. So as part of the 2030 district, all the districts nationally and some internationally are working towards the goals of reducing their energy, water, and transportation related emissions 50% by the year 2030. So these are very bold goals, but it's really what we need to do to stay on target to meet the Paris Climate Agreement. So those goals are in place so that we can, you know, reach that by 2030, those target areas. And that's really to head off the worst effects of climate change. So locally here, we have building members that sign on to the 2030 district and voluntarily commit to making their reductions in all of those three areas or pillars. So early on, though, when we were just a group of volunteers, we started to map out what we wanted to do for Cincinnati and how we thought we could achieve it. And really at the bottom line for all of us was the notion that this is really here for the people, that we're very, you know, we need to make these improvements to the buildings to make a sustainable community. And at the center of that is the community or the health of the people. So we've boldly decided to go after a fourth pillar, and that's in occupant health. And that occupant health area is where we're working with other organizations to increase occupant health. So that's kind of, there's a lot of aspects to the Cincinnati 2030 district. We have our fingers in a lot of areas, but if you just think of it all as built environment related, then that's a good way to think about what we do. And commercial buildings, I should say.
Elizabeth, we're talking about Cincinnati's response to sustainability. You mentioned the Paris Climate Agreement, and we should note that President Trump, when he was in office, removed the country from that agreement. President Biden has
put us back into it. How does federal and international policy impact what you're trying to do at the local level? Are there times where people in your line of work might feel jerked around a little bit? Because if there aren't more people in other parts of the country and the world engaging in this type of activity, how fruitful can your work truly be?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Michael. And it's interesting. We see it in kind of two directions. First of all, you know, at a state level, we saw HB6 really impact the energy efficiency and the renewable incentives. And so that's had a dramatic, you know, reach through our whole state.
You're talking about the legislation in Ohio related to what's been referred to as a nuclear bailout that ultimately led to a federal investigation, including an indictment against former House Speaker Larry Householder.
Yes.
Okay.
And so that had some implications here locally for kind of hemming in organizations' ability to have the incentives there locally that are necessary to help move things along. But what we've also seen is that the a lot of the organizations, these many of them large scale, have very quickly joined the Cincinnati local community towards these reductions through the Cincinnati 2030 district. So while we don't have the incentives, we still have, in a lot of ways, an eagerness to keep things moving and to make those reaches, those stretches towards those goals.
That's Elizabeth Rojas, Green Umbrella Cincinnati 2030 District Director. We're also joined by Allison McKenzie, Sustainability Director at architecture firm SHP and past president of Cincinnati Architecture Institute of America. And also with us today is Paul Yankee. He's president of Green Building Consulting. Paul, I think with sustainable development, it might cross our mind that we're talking about new construction, but we live in a pretty old city, and there's a lot of historic properties that are being redeveloped across the region. There's some of the more exciting developments. How do you take the old buildings and make them part of this goal for the future?
I think it's the right question to ask, and since new construction represents a very small portion of the residential world and where we live on a pretty common space, and definitely in the commercial, the same difference, I think you have to remember that the building that's already there is going to be the greenest building ever utilized. The embodied carbon, all the energy, all the cost, and the resources that are used to get that building up out of the ground and to replace the products that are there, by its nature, is a very easy equation to do. That's an easy one to be able to say that the amount of time we'd have to spend to be able to get to the positive of all that from a sustainability standpoint is unreachable in most cases. What the hard part is some of the entrenched beliefs in the building community and sometimes in the, I say in the cost community. I'm a recovering banker, so I'm allowed to say this. So I think in ways of dollars. And when we go to what the assumption is that to renovate a historic building or renovate an older building is going to be more expensive, and that people have run the math a ton of times. And it's just easier to tear it down and start over. And that's definitely not true. And I think there's times that hopefully the market helps us make that case, like when we have cost spikes, like right now in a lot of construction materials, that's helping people think that way. But there's an alignment between the existing building stock and process that actually marries the outcome very well. The best buildings that we do, we're blessed to be in the middle of an amazing inventory of historic buildings and over the Rhine here in Cincinnati. And so we've done literally hundreds of buildings in the last 15 years. And it's been an amazing outcome to watch people have a building that they did not think you could upgrade to a building that they has been upgraded, and you're living more comfortably, healthier, absolutely lower energy bills, lower water bills. The outcomes of the residents of those buildings. Actually, it's probably the biggest disparity that we see is in existing neighborhoods, right? New construction tends to get things and bring things back to some equilibrium, but an existing building does not. There's an inertia that needs to be broken to be able to do that work. And once it's done, once it's started, and you start training individuals on how to work on historic buildings and how to do them safely, it'll actually retain the building stock better, along with making amazing life outcomes better for all the residents involved.
Paul, are there lessons from, say, 19th century Victorian era architecture that we are deploying now, maybe revisiting after departing from in the past as a way to be greener?
Oh, I see tons of those. Those are actually some of my favorite ones to point out. I use plaster as a great one all the time. Plaster was an amazing air barrier. So it actually blocked air coming through brick buildings, right? You'd have double brick buildings that are basically just sponges, right? So it has, you know, air and moisture would go through. And plaster, especially really good, well-done plaster like we had at the turn of the century, is amazing. When intact, will hold it. Now, it won't keep it a whole lot warm, right? There's no insulation value there. And so what we did is a good chunk of this last century is we actually went away from some of those tactics while trying to add insulation. And so we added one thing and took away another. And so I don't love the 60s and 70s and 80s for a lot of their building practices. We started to really get smart in the last 30 years. And now we're incorporating a lot more of the air sealing and the insulation, for example. So we definitely learn from these buildings. When you have these old stocks, what probably the best thing I bring up, and Over the Rhine's a great example, you can have two buildings right next to each other, same time frame of built around the Civil War, and you're going to have a building that touching the brick almost would crumble in your hands because there's been a magnifying effect of air and moisture going through the building. And another building, which literally will stand for another 300 years because it's so solid. And that is about controlling your environment. We've gotten smarter over time to realize that controlling our environment actually has health outcomes that we're really excited about, as well as our energy bill. But we needed that, right? We needed that pain almost to go back to some of those older practices, I think.
Allison, we're talking about sustainable development, but another major topic related to housing in our city and region is the affordability of that housing. Is there a relationship between sustainable design and the quest to have more affordable housing here?
Not necessarily, but I would argue that there should be. Having affordable housing and having housing stock that is also sustainable really can and should go hand in hand. When you think about it, it all comes down to, you know, issues of justice and how we treat our society and how we treat our environment. And there are some really great examples of how things can be done together. And I've had the opportunity, thankfully, to work on some of those projects that really put both together in a really elegant way, and often deal with historic buildings or structures as well. We have some great developers locally who really know how to handle those historic structures that Paul was talking about in a way that, you know, preserves them, in a way that improves them, and a way that can be done effectively to create affordable housing units. And, you know, some of the best, most sustainable projects that I've seen in the last, you know, 5-10 years in this area have really married all three of those. I think that most of us cringe a little bit maybe if we see developments that are touting sustainability, but you have to, you know, have $800,000 minimum to buy into them. I think there's just a kind of gut check factor that goes along with that. And I know we've talked a lot about cost and how, you know, that influences decisions, and certainly that's true. But the great thing is that some of the incentive programs that we've talked about and other low-income, you know, housing credits and other things that can become available for development really can work well together to really marry all of our priorities as a community together.
And Elizabeth, I've got about a minute left, and I believe you said just moments ago that basically not only are you focused on the infrastructure and the buildings themselves, but the occupants of these buildings. And I'm wondering if that sentiment plays into the quest for affordable housing and how people who may be vulnerable to the economy might be more participatory in this green goal.
So I agree with everything that Allison commented on. And as part of the 2030 district, we really focus our efforts on the commercial building sector and largely within the within the central business district and uptown. These are the areas that are basically the ones that are creating a lot of the issues because they are the least energy, not that the buildings aren't, but they consume the most energy. So as such, we've been really largely working towards helping establish these healthy building goals that are aimed at the commercial building sector. And while I think that there's ways that the built environment can, be sort of a conduit for change also in the community. And, I like what Allison alluded to, that utilizing the opportunities where they are, that we're creating not just a sustainable community, but also one that is more equitable and giving access to a lot of these ways of improving our community to everyone.
That's Elizabeth Rojas, Green Umbrella Cincinnati 2030 District Director. We've also been joined today by Allison Beer McKenzie, Sustainability Director at architecture firm SHP and past president of the Cincinnati Architecture Institute of America, and Paul Yankee, president at Green Building Consulting. Paul, Elizabeth, Allison, thanks so much for the conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.